on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 81-year-old Fred Machado of Fresno, California. Do the math on that, and you know he's a little young to have served in World War II. He didn't, but he was part of America's effort in the Korean War, and this weekend marks the 60th anniversary of the armistice that brought that forgotten war to a bit of an unsettled end. The demilitarized zone that agreement created is still there along the 38th parallel between North Korea and South Korea. Fred has been back to South Korea as recently as last year. And you were pretty impressed, Fred, weren't you, with what you found in the South?
They're enjoying life as we are in it. You don't see any beggars in the street. I'm kind of ashamed that I go down the street here and there's people in the corners asking for money. You don't see that in Korea. They're prosperity. They're builders. They build ships. Their economy is unbelievable. And why? Because we were there. Why did we go there? To help people gain their freedom. Not for our benefit. We didn't take $1 to our national wealth or an acre of land to our national boundaries. It's only to help people to regain what is rightfully theirs. And I did it, and I do it again today.
I believe you, and I certainly wouldn't try to stop you. When you talk about the prosperity of South Korea, I think one of the things that makes that so impressive is the stark contrast with North Korea and how opposite the situation is there. And I've talked to a lot of Korean War vets. Some people have tried to suggest at some point that there was no victory in the Korean War, or that the task wasn't finished, or it was somehow incomplete. What I hear in your voice is a whole lot of satisfaction that what you all did over there was worthwhile. At the time when that war came to an end, and you had the demilitarized zone that stayed where it was and is still there today, how did you feel about it at the time, and what was the morale of your ship in particular?
I think our strong feeling was that we didn't finish the war like we should have. I had mixed feelings at the time. I thought General MacArthur was right in what he wanted to do, but I think President Truman was right when General MacArthur disobeyed his orders. I have great respect for President Truman and great respect for General MacArthur. We did okay because we preserved South Korea. But we should have preserved the whole Korean Peninsula. Yeah, there's a book out called Prisoners of the Forgotten War. I urge people to read that book because we had hundreds of prisoners of war that went through a living hell. They were starved. They were beaten. They were shot in cold blood. Cold blood. There's an army chaplain at that time. His name is Father Emil Capone. He was from Kansas. The Koreans killed him, finally. But he just recently was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor on, I think, April the 11th, when President Barack Obama presented the Medal of Honor to his family 60 years after his death. But he finally got that award. But what this man did for the wounded, for the sick, for the disappointed is unbelievable. He's got to be an angel in heaven.
Yes, Father Capone's story is incredible. He died of starvation and pneumonia after 7 months as a prisoner of war. His kindness to his fellow prisoners, legendary. He was buried in an unmarked grave, and his remains have never been located. The story goes that in Father Capone's final moments, he prayed for his captors, echoing the words of Jesus on the cross when he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Fred mentioned a book there. There's another book written by Kenneth Eaton of Clovis, California, another Korean War prisoner of war who talked about it on this program. And Ken is still making the rounds sharing his incredible story with that book. It's called Missing Dog Tags, and you can find it online. You talked about preserving freedom for the South Korean people. And I guess in the bigger picture, too, there was this worldwide battle between communist forces and, of course, the side that America was on. When you think about that big picture, and that would unfold again later in Vietnam, and you were part of the early days of that too, but did you guys have that sense then too, that it wasn't just Korea you were fighting for, but in a way it was the world you were fighting for?
No doubt about it. No doubt in our minds that we were fighting the big, in those days was the Soviet Union, which finally broke up. And the Chinese, we weren't even the Chinese. We had no communications with the Chinese in those days, which was, I think, a bad situation. Our allies in the China area was Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, which is right what we did there. But the mainland China, we had no communications with them. They were behind the North Koreans. That's what it was. Well, actually, we're fighting the Chinese. I mean, they came in by the thousands. They crossed the Yellow River. The only way we could have stopped them would have been very seriously. We could have stopped them. There's no question about it. The United States is the strongest country in the world. I want to be the strongest country in the world. I want to negotiate peace. I don't like wars. I want to negotiate out of a position of strength, not a position of fear. I'm real concerned what's happening today. Our armed forces are dwindling. You know, let me go back to the invasion of Incheon in 1950. I wasn't there, but my ship was there. But I kept up with reading what went on. There were 230 ships in that invasion, Navy ships. Plus, we had ships scattered all over the world. Today, we've got, I think, 280 ships in the Navy. That's not enough. I want Congress to wake up. We got to spend money in our national defenses. Let us be the strongest Navy in the world. Let us be the strongest nation in the world. And let us negotiate with our adversaries. But let us negotiate from a position of strength. Let us not be taking pot shots from little guys like Cuba or like Venezuela or in the Middle East now. All this stuff that's going on over there, and we're doing nothing. We're just sitting back and saying it'll be okay. It won't be okay. Some of these people have no regard for human life, and it is our duty to intervene.
You mentioned Incheon, and you weren't there for the invasion, but you were there later, and you were at Pusan as well, two of the well-known spots in the Korean War. What did you witness? What did you see, and what was that like?
What I witnessed in those days was poverty and misery and the need. What we did, we would bring the troops and their equipment into these cities, and then we'd leave. I only walked ashore a little bit. Most of us, we didn't. It's just unload our ship and get back out to sea and go somewhere else. But poverty was terrible. Everything was tore up. I mean, the buildings down. It was a mess.
And when you talk about taking troops, I'm sure the guys that you took to the beach looked a little different when you took them in compared to when you picked them up. Can you put that into words for us?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when we took them in, they were full-fledged, trained, had all their equipment. When you pick them up, some of them were wounded. Some of them had been wounded. Many of them looked weary. It was just a different story. I'll tell you what happened to me one time was my friend that tried to get me to join the Marines. And I told him, no, I'm going to go in the Navy. And one day I ran into him in Yokosuka, Japan. He was on R&R, and I would happen to be there. And I ran into him, and he was so jittery that it was unbelievable what he'd been through.
Made you kind of thankful for your experience?
Yeah. I always thank God for all these things that happened. We did our job. We did what we had to do. But they did. Some of them paid the supreme sacrifice. There's a lot of young men that never lived to see the fruits of their sacrifices. This is what's sad. And if people could appreciate them today, this is what we need to do.
That's kind of why I do this show and why the museum is there, so people understand that that price has been paid, that those sacrifices were made. And if we're not aware of it, we're kind of wasting it, aren't we?
Paul, I want to congratulate you on what you do, because you're keeping this thing alive. And we need to do that, and we need to do more. We need to bring out, let the public know what our people have done. There's been a lot of sacrifices, men and women alike.
I guess one of the other things I want to ask you about, and I want to talk to you about the museum before we're done too. You served in the Korean War, and you stayed on the ship after the war in what was really, I guess, foreshadowing of where the United States forces were going to be for the next 20 years. You were in on something before America's full involvement in Vietnam, but the passage to freedom, basically moving 300,000 people from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. How did you understand what you guys were doing in 1954 on your ship?
Well, we didn't know that there was going to be a major war, of course, after that. But we knew, we learned a great deal of the history of it. Actually, most of us on the ship hadn't heard of Vietnam. The French had been there for 100 years and had been fighting the Viet Cong for 7 years. When they split the country in 1954, then they asked the U.S., for help in evacuating the refugees, anybody that want to, they had 1 year to evacuate anybody that want to come from the north to the south. And likewise, the communists had the same choice. So the French asked us for help. I don't know how many ships we had there, probably, I don't know, 25 or 30 ships. And my ship happened to be one of them. We used to pick up these refugees in Haiphong, bring them to Saigon. This is what really made you say, God, how fortunate we are.
Now we hear your cell phone too, anchors away. That works.
So we went to that operation, Passage to Freedom. Prior to going, as soon as we found out we had to go with that evacuation, our doctor aboard ship at that time was Dr. Tom Dooley. I don't know how many of you, he became a very famous doctor later because he left the Navy and he went and established a number of hospitals in Vietnam and in Laos. He was a great guy. He spoke French fluently. He was from St. Louis, and he had studied a great deal about Vietnam, so he knew the history. And for, heck, 2 or 3 weeks before, they gave us a whole history of what Vietnam was like and what to expect. And we used to bring 2,000 refugees at a time in our ship. We had to convert. We had to leave our boats in Japan, then went to the Philippines, to Subic Bay, to rebuild structures on a ship. We had to put these refugees in a cargo holds where we used to put the cargo and had to build special ladders for them, special stairways for them to go down there. And then we got huge pots to cook rice, and it was a 2.5-day trip, and we fed up rice and sardines. These people, some of them were scared to death because they had been told by the communists, the propagandists, that the Americans going to take you out to sea and dump you off in the ocean and you're going to die. Yeah, they were scared to death. But after a day with us, and we were always told don't mingle with them because these people got sickness and kind of thing. How could you stop from mingling with them? There's 2,000 in there. Right. And little kids, and we tried to play with the little kids, tried to give the kids candy. They wouldn't take it at first, but you eat one and then give it to them and they would eat it. And they couldn't open the cans of sardines. We'd give each one a can of sardines, so they come to us. And we mingled with them. And by the time, two and a half days later, we were friends. Now we took them up to Saigon, and then the Red Cross took them over from there. We made the 3 trips. And then we had been overseas, almost 9 months, I guess, and it was time for us to come back. We were gone 11 months that time. We left here November 7th of 53 and came back in October 9th of 54. It was quite an experience there. I'll tell you, that really touched you to see these people left all their belongings behind. They had nothing but what they carried in the suitcase. And I never forgot one guy bringing a chicken in the back of his back. And of course, we could bring the chicken aboard ship, but that's all he had. These people left everything to flee the tyranny of communism. And again, it makes you think, see how fortunate am I, Lord, that I live in a free country, in a free nation.
Now, I would imagine, after everything you'd seen during the Korean War, and then to see that, and to see how desperate these people were for that little sliver of freedom, that you probably haven't taken freedom for granted since then.
No. You know, it's a precious thing to have. The thing is that they fled their homes for freedom, and on the end, they lost the whole thing because the whole country became communist. I sort of blame our politicians for what happened. All that war could have been avoided. It could have been avoided when Ho Chi Minh came to the United States and asked for help in the independence, but now we settled with the French. The French stab you in the back every time you turn around. I don't have much use for that government.
Well, and I imagine, because you, after that, you got out of the Navy, and you've told us a little bit about how you got your start out here with the rented farmland, and here you are with the Statue of Liberty out front of your property and all your almonds and raisin grapes here, and you've been married 57 years and have the family you have. But as that Vietnam War raged on, how often did you think about those 6,000 refugees you'd carried on your ship?
I thought a lot about them. I thought a lot about it. I thought about what was going on. And when I used to watch the news and see the progress, I said, my God, this thing isn't right. We're not doing right. It was always a fear. We could have stopped it. There's no question about it. We had the strength. It was the fear that maybe the Chinese were going to come in. We could have stopped them too. But then you've read Russia at that time. I'm not a politician, but had I been in Washington in charge, I think things would have been different.
Fred Machado doesn't mince words, does he? More with this Korean War veteran when we come back. The armistice that brought that war to a halt was official on July 27th, 1953, 60 years ago. There's another anniversary coming up next year that I'm going to bend your ear about in a moment. If you want to see what Fred looked like 60 years ago and what he looks like now in his front yard with his wife Maxine in front of their big Statue of Liberty, just go to Facebook and type in Hometown Heroes Radio. We'll be right back after this. Central California has plenty of talented musicians. That's not news. But this is. 45 musicians from the area are hoping to head to Normandy next June to take part in the 70th anniversary commemoration of the D-Day landings. They'll represent the Clovis Community Band. Clovis Mayor Lynn Ashbeck will go along, and the Clovis Veterans Memorial District has given them a great head start on their fundraising goal. I've got the perfect way for you to help, too. All you have to do is eat some delicious food, catered by Pardini's, enjoy some outstanding music that Joe Lennigan Band will perform, you can dance to your heart's content, and there are some pretty impressive auction items you might want to bid on too. It's the Night to Remember Dinner Dance, Saturday night, August 17th in Clovis, and all the proceeds will help make these dedicated local musicians a special part of D-Day's 70th anniversary. To reserve your tickets for the dinner dance, call 559-431-3160. That's 559-431-3160. And go online to find out more about this sentimental journey by visiting ClovisCommunityBandDday.org.